You can turn in your Bibles to Daniel chapter 3. We'll read verses 1 through 18. Just as some preliminary thoughts, I don't want to take thoughts from the passage that our brother might be sharing with us, but this passage is a picture also of what we're going to see in the end times playing out again. Revelation chapter 17 talks about Mystery Babylon, the mother of harlots. And so we're going to see a revived Babylonian empire in the end times. And I'd like to read verse 14 from Revelation 17, 14, talking about that time and the harlot and Babylon. These shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and they that are with him are called, chosen, and faithful. Think about that as we read Daniel chapter 3. We see God there as Lord of lords and King of kings, even though there's an earthly power, Nebuchadnezzar, and we see the people that are with the Lord of lords and the King of kings as the called and the chosen and the faithful. Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold, whose height was 70 cubits and the breadth thereof 6 cubits. He set it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Then Nebuchadnezzar the king sent to gather together the princes, the governors and the captains and the judges, the treasurers, the counselors, the sheriffs and all the rulers of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image which Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. Then the princes and governors and captains, the judges, the treasurers, the counselors, the sheriffs, and all the rulers of the provinces were gathered together unto the dedication of the image which that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then an herald cried aloud, "To you it is commanded, O people, nations, and languages, that at what time ye hear the sound of the cornet, the flute, the harp, sackbut, psaltery, dulcimer, and all kinds of music, ye shall fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king hath set up." There we see the power of the influence of music. "And whoso falleth not down and worshipeth shall the same hour be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. Therefore at the time when all the people heard the sound of the cornet, the flute, the harp, the sackbut, the psaltery, and all kinds of music, all the people, the nations, and the languages fell down and worshipped the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. Wherefore at that time certain Chaldeans came near and accused the Jews. They spake and said to the king, 'Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. Thou, O king, hast made a decree that every man shall hear the sound of, the cornet, the flute, the harp, the sackbut, the psaltery, and the dulcimer, and all kinds of music shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoso falleth not down and worshipeth, that he should be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom thou hast set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego. These men, O king, have not regarded thee. They serve not thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up.' Then Nebuchadnezzar, in his rage and fury, commanded to bring Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego. They brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar spake and said unto them, 'Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that do not ye serve my gods, nor worship the golden image which I have set up? Now if ye be ready, at what time ye hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, dulcimer, and all kinds of music, ye fall down and worship the image which I have made, well. But if ye worship not, ye shall be cast the same hour into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. And who is that God that shall deliver you out of my hands?' Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego answered and said to the king, 'O Nebuchadnezzar, we are not careful to answer thee in this matter. If it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of thine hand, O king. But if not, be it known unto thee, O king, that we will not serve thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up.' Let's come before the Lord in prayer.
Thank you for your prayers on my behalf this evening. And Brother Paul for his prayer. After a beautiful day that we were able to enjoy. Missionary Stanley Soltau, while serving in Korea in the 1920s, met a young man named Chin-Soo Kim, a student whom he embraced as a son. Chin-Soo went on to seminary and was ordained a minister. The two men became inseparable. In 1936, the occupying Japanese government ordered all Korean schools to bow before the shrine of a Japanese goddess. Mission schools were not exempt, and Christian students and teachers suddenly faced the same challenge that was encountered by the Hebrew children. Intense persecution raged against the Christians with over 60,000 arrests. And as Stanley left Korea, Chin-Soo met him at the station, and he said this, "Father," Chin-Soo said as that train prepared to depart, he said, "I fear hard times ahead of it for us. The stand we are taking against shrine worship, tell me again that we are doing the right thing." "There is no question about it," answered Stanley. And as he boarded the train, Chin-Soo pressed a paper into his hand. Taking his seat, Stanley read it. Here's what it said, and I quote, "Of one thing I am certain, you will never feel ashamed of your son. Whatever comes, I am looking to the Lord for his enabling power," end quote. Years later, Stanley learned of Chin-Soo's fate. Soon after their parting, Chin-Soo had been arrested by the Japanese police because of his refusal to bow before the Shinto shrine. He was imprisoned and brutally tortured. And one winter day, a friend passing the jail saw a pile of corpses, frozen, stacked like firewood. Among them was Chin-Soo. That story is a modern-day version of what Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego faced in Daniel chapter 3. Each was faced with a decision as to whether they would bow to another god or be true to their god. They needed to decide as to whether their god was worthy of not compromising their beliefs in him. They needed to decide if their god was supreme and he could be trusted in the face of death. And in the end, their decisions left no doubt concerning their commitment to God and their belief that he has no equal. As we look at Daniel 3, the title of the message this evening is, "There is no equal." In the first seven verses of the chapter, and your comments were fine, Brother Paul, there's no way I'm exhausting this chapter this evening. No, we're just kind of hitting here and there. But I appreciated those thoughts, and hopefully we'll glean, or each of us will take some lessons from this tonight. But in the first seven verses of the chapter, we find King Nebuchadnezzar's decree that all who had gathered at this dedication of this massive gold image, which he had set up, were to fall down and worship. Now, this image stood about 90 feet high and 9 feet wide. It was not necessarily solid gold, but it was overlaid with gold at the least. And the image represented Nebuchadnezzar, his kingdom, his greatness, his glory. You will remember back in chapter 2 that Nebuchadnezzar had a dream. And that dream was about an image. And in interpreting that dream, Daniel said this in verses 37 through 38. He said, "Thou, O king, art a king of kings, for the God of heaven hath given thee a kingdom, power and strength and glory. And wheresoever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field and the fowls of the heaven hath he given into thine hand, and hath made thee ruler over them all. Thou art this head of gold." He was saying, your kingdom is the head of gold of this image in your dream. And it seems that Nebuchadnezzar may have used this as the thought behind his making a literal image to worship. However, in his pride, the king overlooked that it was God that had given him the kingdom, the power, and the strength, and the glory. On verse 4 of Daniel 3, it makes it clear, or the king's decree was clear, that bowing to the image, well, this wasn't an option, this was a command. In fact, if ones chose not to obey, then they would be cast into a burning furnace. That gave a little more incentive to obey the command, wouldn't you say? The consequences for not obeying were made clear. In verse 7, we find in obedience to the command, the people, when hearing the music, they fell down and they worshiped the image. And I have a note here too, similar to Paul's. Music, like any other tool, can be used for good or for bad. It can stir someone to worship God. I love good music. I've been impressed with a lot of thoughts and good thoughts and have led me to worship and caused me to be in awe of God and to stand in awe of His grace and His mercy and His love. So music can stir someone to worship God, but it also can stir someone to worship other gods, as the case was here in Daniel 3. Well, verses 8 to 12, again, you can tell I'm not taking this verse by verse, or we'd be here a long time this evening. I don't intend on doing that. In verses 8 to 12, we have the accusation of the three Jews not bowing to the image. Verse 8 says that certain Chaldeans came near and accused the Jews. Now, we don't know if there were other Jews who didn't bow, or how many Jews didn't bow. We don't really know that for sure, but three are signaled out in verse 12, and that's Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego. They're signaled out, and these accusers reminded the king, now remember, king, you made a decree, and remember the consequences that you set. One has to wonder what the motives were of those Chaldeans, of the accusers. Why did they bring this to Nebuchadnezzar's attention that these three hadn't bowed? Well, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were Jews, obviously, and they were foreigners who had been placed, as you recall, had been set over affairs of the province of Babylon by the king in chapter 2. And I can imagine that that didn't set too well with these Chaldeans. And now to top it off, here they were, refusing to show favor or regard the king, to show respect in their minds, and refused to bow to the image that he had set up. Another question is, were these Chaldeans some of the same ones whose lives were spared in chapter 2? Because Daniel was able to interpret the king's dream that they couldn't interpret. And you remember that the king had given the command that unless they can interpret it, they were going to be killed. And Daniel, through the power of God, saved lives in interpreting that dream. Were they some of the same? Was this a case of repaying good with evil? Whatever the case, and we can speculate, but whatever the case, in light of this accusation, we should note this, I think, for ourselves. When we form an accusation in our minds, and I doubt whether there's anybody here that has never formed an accusation in our mind, in your mind. When we form an accusation in our minds, or when we form them with words, what are our motives behind them? I wonder that we may be surprised if we give an honest answer to that, and I include myself. Another question we could ask here at this point is, where was Daniel? Daniel's not mentioned. There's, again, speculation that can be or different things that can be thought, a possibility where he was. Maybe he wasn't there. He was on business somewhere else for the king. Maybe he was there and wasn't signaled out. One thing I'm sure of, and I think you're certain of, he didn't bow if he was there. So the accusation of these three in verses 8 to 12. Then in verses 13 to 18, we see the Jews' response to the accusation. And after being told about the three Jews who did not bow to his image, Nebuchadnezzar wasn't too happy, as you can imagine. Verse 13, he went on, let me get back to 13 in Daniel 3. He says, then Nebuchadnezzar in his rage and fury commanded to bring Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego, and they were brought before the king. And he goes on to ask them, is it true, or was it your purpose? And I think he's asking, in other words, did you do this on purpose? Was it your idea to purposely not bow before the image that I've set up? And then in verse 15, the king offers them one more chance to comply to his decree. Maybe they missed it. So he's giving them another opportunity, or at least extending, in his mind, probably thinking, I'm extending mercy and giving another opportunity to bow to this image. One more chance to right themselves before the king. But notice the second half of verse 15, where Nebuchadnezzar said, but if you worship not, he said, in other words, if you fall down and worship this time, all is well. But if you worship not, you shall be cast the same hour in the midst of a burning fiery furnace. And who is that God that shall deliver you out of my hands? I think that's a key statement at the end of that verse. Here King Nebuchadnezzar laid down a line of defiance. Not so much towards Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, but more towards their God. Who's that God that's going to be able to deliver you out of my hands? When we as believers take a stand for God, when we take a stand for our convictions that are based on His Word, and the response of the response of unbelievers may seem like it's against us, but in reality, it is in defiance against the God we serve. I think we need to see that. When the enemies of God's people oppress God's people, and this does not mean that God's weak or that somehow he's lost control or that he's not noticing or paying attention, but rest assured that God takes notice, and that at some point, He will choose to deliver His people, and He will punish His enemies. God takes notice when somebody takes a stand for Him and somebody in defiance of God oppresses His people. Verses 16 to 18, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego give their response to the king's inquiry and to his second chance offer, you might say. And their response is an answer, a testimony for the ages. I'm saying this evening that it's one that we need to take as our very own. That needs to become our own testimony, our own answer. Let's read that again starting in verse 16, where they said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we are not careful to answer thee in this matter. If it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of thine hand, O king. But if not, be it known unto thee, O king, that we will not serve thy gods nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up. They were saying that, yes, it is true. We purposely didn't bow the first time. And guess, you know what? We haven't changed our mind. We're not going to try to defend our actions. What we did was on purpose, and we haven't changed our thinking. Our decision now is the same as it was then. We're committed to our God. We'll serve Him and no other. We place our lives into His hands. We know He's able to deliver us from the fiery furnace, but if He chooses not to, our God still will deliver us from you, one way or another, because you can only take our lives, but you can't take our God. Regardless of whether God chooses to keep us from death, we still will not change our minds and serve your gods, because even so, he'll deliver us in death. These three Hebrew men, their faith, their trust, and their confidence in God was not based on expecting a miracle. It was not, they weren't thinking, well, you know, I'm not going to bow that image. I'm going to, because I think God's going to make a, give us a miracle. Well, it wasn't based on that. It was based on the fact that their trust and their complete confidence in a God, and that they believed there was no equal to him. That he was worthy of their obedience to him. Their God was supreme. They would have trust and confidence in him no matter what he chose to do with them. To do with them, no matter what the consequences were. Their trust in God did not hinge on what he did, but it hinged on who he was, and that no other God, no other person was equal to him. I love those statements. Verse 16, we are not careful to answer thee in this matter. They were simply saying, look, we don't have to rethink it. We already know our answer. We're not going to change our mind. We don't have to study about this. We know what our answer is. And then in verse 18, when they said, be it known unto thee, their testimony was steadfast. It was sure. It was not negotiable. They said, let it be known. This is what we've decided. We're not changing. Oh, that this is my testimony for the rest of my life. And your testimony, that I'm committed to God, that I don't need to rethink it. There's nothing that'll make me change it. My trust in God, my confidence in him is sure. It's not negotiable. Be it known as such. Oh, that's my testimony the rest of my life and yours. You know, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they could have used a number of reasons why they could have bowed to that image, and maybe why they could have thought they should have. Thoughts like this. We'll bow down in body, but we'll not actually worship. Or maybe we'll do it this time and then ask God to forgive us. Or we need to obey the king. After all, he's been really good to us. He's given us a position in government and authority. God will understand. Or perhaps thought we're in a foreign land, not our own people or customs. God will not expect us to cause a problem. Who's going to know? Or maybe we're in a place of authority. We can help our people because of the position of authority we have. If we don't bow to this image and we're put in the fiery furnace and we die, what help can we be to our people? Therefore, we ought to bow, because we'll be more good that way. Maybe they could have even thought, well, you know what? To bow to this image would not be as bad as those who have set up idols in our own temple back home. This wouldn't be as bad. They didn't think any of those thoughts. If they did, they disregarded them quickly. I don't think they thought them, because their answer was steadfast and sure. The truth was that if they'd have bowed to the image, these three Jews would have disobeyed God's command that says, thou shalt have no other gods before me. Speaking of God, and their testimony would have been destroyed. Think of it. Their testimony would have been destroyed. How could they have claimed to the people of Babylon after that their God is the greatest God and there's no one equal to him if they'd have bowed to another God? Stands the reason that we need to be careful. That we don't present that message to other people. I'm willing to give in and do this. What do they say? Well, his God mustn't be any greater than what I serve. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego obeyed the king as far as they could, but knew when they had to take a stand alone for God. You know, that's where we're at a lot of times. It's okay to go so far, and then there's a line, and we know that we can't cross it, where we have to take a stand for God. I believe it's our human nature, and I say our human nature, and I understand that I'm talking about the human nature. Our human nature is that we would rather be wrong with a group than we would be right by ourselves. You think that's accurate? I think it is. We'd rather be wrong with a group, because there's company, than to stand alone and be right. The truth is that we need to be right with God on our side, no matter who else is willing to stand with us, or if anybody stands with us. You know, are there some times when we don't stand up for Christ, that we don't stand up for God? I've failed in the past. What kind of excuses do we use? Maybe some of those that I mentioned a little bit ago. Nobody will know. This won't hurt anybody. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego knew. They clearly knew that there was a price for disobedience to this God, little g, Nebuchadnezzar's. But they also knew that there was a steeper price for disobedience to their God, the true God. I'm sure that they desired to continue to live. They wouldn't have been normal. I don't think they wanted to die. They desired to continue to live, and it's normal to want to avoid death. But they knew that the real issue here was not really living or dying. Physically, that wasn't the issue. That wasn't what was at stake. Rather, the issue was whether they would obey their God. And if he was supreme to all gods, then in other words, that meant then he would be deserving of their obedience. That was the issue. And if he was, they had to choose to obey him. Something for us to note is this, that not obeying God always means we are obeying someone else. Someone else. And whether we realize it or not, we are implying that someone else, and it may be myself, because it's following selfish desires or whatever, we're implying that someone else is equal to God. Follow me? If we choose to disobey God, we always are choosing to obey someone else and implying that someone else that is on the same level of God because I chose to obey them instead of God. You see, too often, well, maybe this isn't true with you. Too often, we want to bow to make ourselves our own gods. There's been too many times for me, I'll say that at least. Maybe bowing to the images of pleasure or possessions or money or pride. Or power. Or opinions. Whether they're mine or someone else's. When we face the choice to obey God or not to obey him, our decision should not be dictated by what will happen to us physically, one way or the other. Rather, it should be based on believing our God is worthy of our obedience, meaning he has no equal to him, and because of that, we want to obey him, and he deserves our obedience. Sure, the consequences, we understand that, and we make choices. I don't want to do this because of consequences, but the ultimate reason why I choose to obey God, why you choose to obey him, I believe should be that I think he's supreme and he's worthy of my obedience. There is no one equal to him, and therefore I'm going to choose to obey him regardless of what the consequences are, whether he gives me good or bad as a result. Something else that we should note here is that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had taken a stand for God. If you remember back in chapter 1, in what we might say is lesser circumstances, where they refused to eat the king's meat and the king's wine. They didn't want to defile themselves with the king's meat or the king's wine. Here's the point. Like they did. When we take a stand for God in what we might think are the lesser circumstances, it helps prepare us to do so in the greater circumstances, just as they did when they were faced with the decision, it's bow or burn. So the little decisions and the little choices of standing for God or not are important, because they're helping to plant or to provide a foundation that we'll stand on when it comes to a point. And who knows who of us will come to that point. And it could mean a life or death issue. In verses 19 to 23, we find Nebuchadnezzar's response to the Jews' answer. Verse 19 says he was full of fury, so much that it changed the visual, the appearance of his face. He was that angry. He commanded that they make the furnace extremely hot. Verse 22 says this. Let's read a couple of verses beginning in 22. Therefore, because the king's commandment was urgent and the furnace exceeding hot, the flame of the fire slew those men that took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell down bound into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. It's interesting that he chose the mightiest men of his army and he had them bind up. These three, he was that upset, not mad, that he had them bound up by his mightiest men. And he lost those mighty men because they died when they got too close to that furnace. It was that hot. Humanly speaking, there was no way that these three Hebrews could live in that fire. No way. But in verses 24 to 25, we find God's response to the three Jews' commitment. Look at those verses. Then Nebuchadnezzar the king was astonished and rose up to haste and spake and said unto his counselors, did not we cast three men bound into the midst of the fire? They answered and said unto the king, true, O king. He answered and said, lo, I see four men loose, walking in the midst of the fire, and they have no hurt, and the form of the fourth is like the Son of God. Now, Son of God there does not necessarily mean the pre-incarnate Christ or Jesus. It could have been. But Nebuchadnezzar seemed to know that that fourth person was some kind of supernatural heavenly being that had come to help the three that had been tossed in. And then in verses 26 to the end of the chapter, we find Nebuchadnezzar's response to the Jews' deliverance. Beginning of verse 26, then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the mouth of the burning fiery furnace and spake, said, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, ye servants of the Most High God, come forth and come hither. Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came forth in the midst of the fire. And the princes, governors, and captains, and the king's counselors, being gathered together, saw these men upon whose bodies the fire had no power, nor was an hair of their head singed, neither were their coats changed, nor the smell of fire had passed on them. I remember one time getting a little too close to a candle and I singed my hair. Here they are in the burning furnace and they didn't even singe their hair. They didn't even smell like smoke. And Nebuchadnezzar spake and said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants that trusted in him and have changed the king's word and yielded their bodies that they might not serve nor worship any god except their own God." Listen, when God does a miracle, there's no humanly possible way of explaining it. No way can you humanly explain how those three men survived that fire, didn't get their hair singed, and didn't even smell like smoke. How what they were bound with burned off of them, but they didn't burn themselves. When God does a miracle, there's no humanly possible way of explaining it. You know, God doesn't always choose to deliver in this way. Many a people have died for their faith. If he did choose to deliver this way every time a believer was in a fix like that, how much faith would we need? Our Christianity would become more like an insurance policy that we just grab a hold of and use it instead of a relationship. Notice in verse 28, who does God deliver? Who does God deliver? Nebuchadnezzar got it right. He said, those who trust in him. And he goes on to say, have changed the king's word. They've yielded their bodies. In other words, they acted on that trust. God delivers those who trust in him and are willing to act on that trust. He doesn't always deliver the same way, but rest assured, he does always deliver one way or another. You see, we just think too much in our human minds like deliverance means living longer in this life. It doesn't always mean that. Verse 29, therefore, the king's still speaking, I make a decree that every people, nation, and language would speak anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Boy, we could use this one today, couldn't we? Shall be cut in pieces, and their houses shall be made of dunghill, because there is no other God that can deliver after this sort. Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. Why did Nebuchadnezzar make this new decree? Why did he make this new one? Because there is no other God that can deliver like their God. That's what he said. There was no equal. Even King Nebuchadnezzar admitted that there was no equal to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego's God. You see, Bel, the Babylonian god, he couldn't even keep those mighty men from being burned at the entrance of the furnace, much less protect those that were inside. The God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego is our God, right? That's our God. There's no equal to him. Because of that, he's worthy of our obedience. He's worthy of our confidence and our trust, regardless of what the consequences are. And we don't base it on what the consequences will be. But we stand on the principles of God's word, and we stand for him because there's no equal to him. to listen to the words that the songwriter put down. It says this: "History is full of men's achievements, but frail are these ventures at their very best. While we toast our success, you," speaking about God, "you, God, create another day. And I can see how you might be amused. Centuries have raised up gods and heroes," little g's, "but feeble is their bid for immortality. While you, God, now and eternally are the great I am. Forever is the dominion you bring. You are the one immortal king. There is no equal to you, O God. Above all others, supremely you reign. The whole of heaven and earth stands in awe. There's no equal to you, God. Who can claim the planet as their enterprise? No one else is master of the master plan. Only you speak a word and the laws of nature change, and even time runs its course to your throne, where it will bow to you alone. There is no equal to you, O God. Above all others, supremely you reign. The whole of heaven and earth stands in awe. There is no equal to you, O God. There is no equal. You're without rival. No contender. Who is like you, O Lord? There is none." That needs to be at the foundation of why we obey him. Why we choose to stand for him against any other God. God help us to do that.
We settled in our choice for Christ? That's the question that I was challenged with tonight. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, it was settled in their mind and heart. They weren't going to waver. Not too long ago, 300 girls, probably at gunpoint, were asked to deny Christ and possibly, if not, take a bullet. One faithful brother said, "As for me and my house, we're going to serve the Lord." And that's it. Not too long ago, Sherry and I were talking, my wife and I. There come a day here that we might be challenged with the fact that, are we going to stand faithful if it means a bullet? Are we going to stay faithful? Fear not the one who can destroy the body, but he who can destroy both body and soul and send it to an eternal hell. Shall we stand for prayer?